Well, hello, welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast. We've chosen another one. It's your podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, the podcast.
Yes, that's us. You should say those titles again.
No, an email, at Books of the Year, a podcast. An email from Sian in Corsham in Wiltshire. Simon and Matt, I've been meaning to message you for ages to say thank you for recommending books that I would never have considered reading. From Joe Browning Rowe's A Terrible Kindness to S.A. Crosby's All the Sinners Bleed. If I had seen these books in a bookshop without your recommendation, I wouldn't even have thought to pick them up. Mad Honey has been another standout for me. I'm a huge Jodi Picoult fan, so you were preaching to the choir there. Jodie's going to be with us with her new book.
She is, shortly, yeah.
So I just wanted to say thanks for expanding my reading palette. I love the podcast, listen to every episode, and I love your book, Simon. Oh, hang on, this is going to be Knife. Love your book, Simon, Knife Edge. And then books, it only mentions one. What about the others?
I love your books, is what she's saying. And then comma, an example, knife edge. Comma, knife edge.
Okay, I kind of feel as though there's a line missing in which she mentions all the other books.
Yes, no, it goes through the entire bibliography.
Keep up the good work, Sian. Yeah. Anyway, you might like to know, Sian, there's a kind of a follow-on from Knife Edge
yes,
on the way.
Yes, there is. When are we able to
I think it's January.
January, okay.
Next year.
Oh, right, lovely. Excellent. Aurelie Taylor has been in touch. Says, dear Bookmark and Fold the Page, I see, there's a new Ben McIntyre book just out. I do hope he'll be making an appearance on the podcast. Yes, he is. And you will have known that before this comes out because he was on the episode before this one. So I'm sure you're very happy with that, Aurelie. We were always delighted to get Ben on. He always picks excellent subjects.
Unless Aurelie is talking about the next
Ben McIntyre. Next Ben McIntyre. He's already given us a hint. He's given us a taste of what that is. It's something Cold War-y, which I'm all down for.
Yes, which sounds very exciting. If you want to get in touch, email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Instagram and Threads, pick any page. You can also, because you're on
I'm on
Twitter,
X, yeah, yeah.
And I'm on there.
Yeah, yeah.
And also Blue Sky.
You're on Blue Sky. I've yet to tread those boards or the Threads, really. I mean, I'm on Threads, but I've not done the thing on it yet.
So you never look at it, so there's no point.
There's no point yet. Not until everyone leaves the hellscape that is X.
Okay.
You know.
Anyway, let's talk to today's special guest. He is international best-selling author and one of our favourites, Robert Harris. Matt and I are in general agreement that our favourite day is a Robert Harris day.
Indeed, we are, yeah.
And unfortunately, they only come along every couple of years or so. So could you write a little bit faster, please?
Yeah, I would like to. I have had periods when I've done a book a year, but I think I'm getting old, actually. It's harder to do it.
The last time we spoke was Act of Oblivion, and we were, I think, Matt and I were in our separate homes.
We were definitely, yeah.
It was all being done under... Yeah. COVID restrictions. So happier times to be reading your new book, which is called Precipice. Matt, describe the cover, please.
Yes, it's a sort of, appropriately enough, it's a sort of vertigo-inducing front cover. So imagine yourself at the bottom of a flight of steps leading up to the Houses of Parliament with Big Ben or Elizabeth Tower or whatever looming in the background. And you've got a figure in a bowler hat stepping down those steps. And you can see two figures behind him. One's a woman with a big hat on, and another is a man with a top hat on, and then some crows flying past over a what would appear sort of dusk in London. The number one bestseller, Robert Harris in White, Precipice in Gold.
Do they send you lots of ideas for the covers, Robert? Do you have a very strong and clear guidance that you give?
There's a very good guy called Glenn who has done most of my covers, actually, more than a dozen. This one he hit on straight away. The figure, the male figure you mentioned in the top hat at the back, is actually Asquith, the Prime Minister.
Is that right?
Yes, you can't tell it, but if you blew it up enough, that is actually him.
And And who's the guy walking down the steps?
That I don't know. I assume it's a model. You know, they hire actors for the shoots. So I don't know who the other two are. But the guy who was the prime minister, he didn't. The figure that they used didn't look like him. And I said, you know, someone's going to spot that. And so they actually made it him. So that's accurate, at least.
So there are three figures that... Can you just introduce us to... So Herbert Henry Asquith is prime minister. So the book is Summer of 1914. Before the First World War, that's where we start. He's Prime Minister. Just introduce us to him. What do we need to know about him? Venetia Stanley and also the Special Constable Paul Deemer. They're the three people that we follow through the story.
Yeah, Asquith by this time had been Prime Minister for more than 6 years. He was head of a minority government propped up by the Irish Nationalists and the Labour Party. He was a very dominant figure, brilliant, probably the cleverest man who was ever Prime Minister intellectually. He had a couple of weaknesses. One was drink. Asquith was known as Squiff or Squiffy, but he was still very capable of functioning. And the other one was he was very fond of the company of young women. We would say that nowadays that he's not safe in the back of a taxi, a kind of hand on the knee, arm round the waist kind of a guy. His chief preoccupation in 1914, in July when the book opens, is Ireland. He had to introduce Irish Home Rule. Otherwise, the Irish Nationalists would withdraw their support for the government. And it looked as though there would be a civil war in Ireland. The Ulster Unionists were arming. The Tories were backing them. And so this was his main preoccupation. And the assassination of the Archduke in Sarajevo, which led to the First World War, was just a tiny thing. Nobody was bothering about it at all. But I tried to convey at the beginning of the book how this thing gradually gets worse and worse and worse.
So, and do we need to know anything about Venetia Stanley and your special constable?
Well, Venetia is 26. She has a 27th birthday. Asquith is 61. They're having an affair. It's particularly intense in 1914. He wrote her in all 560 letters. Sometimes he would write to her three times a day. She was a socialite, aristocratic. Her family were extremely wealthy. Her father had been a Liberal MP. She had been the best friend of Asquith's daughter, Violet. She was an independent woman, interesting, clever, bored. And I think it flattered her to have the Prime Minister dancing attention on her, and he used to send her secret documents and show her classified information. They would go for a regular afternoon drive once a week for about an hour and a half into the countryside, and this is when they were alone and when whatever happened between them. And Deemer is a character I had to introduce to really take the reader into this world, because I felt if I just described it, the relationship between the two of them, people would find it very hard to relate to. So he's like a representative of us. And what happened in August 1914, after war had been declared, was that fragments of Foreign Office telegrams started turning up in fields, Goring-on-Thames, Henley-on-Thames, St James's Park. And these were handed in to the local police, who forwarded them to Scotland Yard. And Scotland Yard then went to the Foreign Office and said, what's going on? These were decrypted, top secret telegrams from ambassadors. And what was happening was that Asquith was showing them to Venetia Stanley and screwing them up and throwing them out of the window. And when I read about that, I thought, well, there's the character I can introduce. There was a leak inquiry. So this guy investigates what the hell is going on.
And just one other point, just as a kind of a setup before we get into the nuts and bolts of the story, how did you come by this treasure trove of information?
Well, I've always been interested in politics, especially British 20th century politics. So I knew about these letters. Venetia kept every letter that Asquith ever wrote to her. And they were, after she died in 1948, her daughter discovered them, a lot of them on 10 Downing Street, had a notepaper. And they were found their way into print first in a very Baudelaireized form in Roy Jenkins's very good biography of Asquith, published in 1964. And then in 1982, a scholarly edition of the letters, about half of them, was published by the Oxford University Press. And I read that, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And so it was one of those stories that's always been at the back of my mind. I mean, I thought I've always been interested in power. And, you know, the way, and this sort of, I wanted to write a novel about a prime minister, and I thought of inventing one. And then I thought, no, why don't I write about him? Because no one dealt with such huge problems as Asquith did, or was a more interesting character in many ways.
But you had access to the letters that we hadn't seen.
Yeah, the letters are in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. They're all there. They're available for scholars to inspect. And Asquith's great-granddaughter, one of the Bonham Carters, Jane Bonham Carter, I went with her and her sister to look at them, and they helped me and encouraged me to do the book. So, yeah, so I've handled the letters.
Astonishingly, well, you read, you put a note right at the start of the book saying that all the letters that you read in this book from the Prime Minister to Venetia are authentic. These are actually what he wrote. And as you're reading the book, your mouth is on the floor because you can't believe what he's saying to her and B, the secrets he's revealing. You've said he writes to her three times a day, which shouts out, by the way, in the book, oh my goodness, what a post office we had in 1914. How many deliveries were you getting a day? Goodness me.
12 deliveries a day.
12 deliveries a day. But as you've all already alluded to, he was showing her secret documents. He was sharing telegrams. He was sharing information that not only had he not told the House, he hadn't even told the Cabinet sometimes, these secrets. Yet he brought in the Official Secrets Act, which is... here's my question to you. What do you think is going through his head when there are points in this story where he clearly can see that there is an investigation into these screwed up telegrams. So a normal person at that point would surely be thinking, why am I need to stop sharing all these secrets because someone's onto me. She reveals at one point, oh yes, I've been sharing these secrets with the family at breakfast. At that point, surely you go, right, I won't be sending anything else. What's going through his mind when he keeps on doing it?
Well, he was very nervous when she was sort of ambushed, I think, and had to read out something just before war was declared. And he said, oh, I hope you were careful in what you said to them. And she was. He was right to trust her, actually. She didn't really tell anyone or show anyone the documents. She kept them in a painted wooden box in her bedroom. I think you say a normal person wouldn't have done this. Well, a normal person doesn't end up prime minister, by and large. They have drives and appetites and an arrogance and a feeling of immunity that maybe the rest of us don't have. He was born in 1852, Asquith. He was a Victorian. I mean, I think he had a sort of different code of how public affairs was conducted among gentlemen. And he was obsessed with her, and he valued her advice quite genuinely, and he used her as a sounding board. And it's a lonely position being prime minister. Everyone who gives you advice, you have to think what's in it for them, and can you trust them with telling them what's in your heart? So she became the outlet, and he was dependent on her like a heroin addict or something, you know. And he wanted to draw her in and show her every aspect of his life, and maybe show off a bit as well, I suppose.
Yeah, after about the kind of 10th, 11th, 12th letter, I did find myself, I think I said it out loud, oh, don't be so pathetic. but he writes like he's a love-struck teenager. Yes. With the emotional intelligence of a teenager. You know, it's like a first love. He's in his 60s and she's in his 20s. I mean, the age gap is interesting, but is he in a fantasy world?
I think that he fantasized about them eloping together, definitely. And when she began to drift apart, because her reaction, frankly, was yours. I mean, you know, this is getting ridiculous. And she started to drift away she from him and cast around for a means of escaping the affair. So I think that, you know, it's sort of... I think that it was there were strong elements of fantasy. I don't believe he would have left his wife, and it would have been complete social ruin if he did that. And I don't believe, really, he was so depressed about the thought of losing her that he thought of suicide, which is what he said to her. This is an enormous amount of emotional pressure for a war leader to put on a young woman who's, a lot of whose relatives are now in the armed forces fighting.
The gold in your books, Robert, which we've spoken to you so many times, both here and when we were doing this on Radio 2, is, and I remember when we had you in to talk about Munich, and there was a little fact in that book about how, and it's always stuck with me, that in Munich there were people singing songs about Neville Chamberlain because everyone was hoping there was not going to be another war, and so they literally Germans singing songs about Neville Chamberlain. The little gold that I loved in here is that the Prime Minister at the time could walk pretty much unbothered down the street. No one knew who he was. He's the Prime Minister. He could travel around and no one knows he's the Prime Minister. Perhaps nearer the war they start to recognise him. But for a long scale, there is, you know, he could basically walk down the street.
Yes, and this made the, I think this is one of the things that made the affair possible. I mean, it was an extraordinary period and towards the end of October 1914 where he decided he wanted to see her. She was in the family estate up in Cheshire, in Alderley Edge, and he just caught the train, hailed a cab, went to Euston Station entirely on his own, and went up to Macclesfield, then changed to the branch line, and he was away from his desk for 4 days without a secretary or a bodyguard. He also travelled without security. The only time he had security, really, was before the war, when the suffragettes used to try and attack him. Then he had to have a detective accompanying him, but at this point, amazingly, during the First World War, he had no armed protection at all.
It is the suggestion of your book, Robert, that he was so distracted that it cost the war effort. Would that be correct?
I don't know how far one can push that. I think that he definitely hadn't got 100% of his focus on the job, and there were two episodes in 1915 that are in the novel. One is the crucial meeting in January 1915 where Churchill laid out the plans for the Dardanelles operation. And he spent half an hour of that meeting writing to her, because he starts the letter, 3:30, my darling, your sweet letter has just arrived, been brought in to me, and so on. And at 4 o'clock, he says, 4 o'clock, Winston's still talking. Very interesting. I must tell you about it next time I see you. Well, this proved to be an absolute military disaster, as you know. Just British lives, 32,000 men were killed in what became a completely crazy operation. He also, there was a lot, big scandal that the armaments industry wasn't providing enough shells for the troops in fighting in France. Lord Kitchener, the Secretary of State for War, had a word with the Commander-in-Chief, Sir John French, and reported back to Asquith that he's got enough shells for his next attack. And Asquith immediately put this memo from Kitchener in the post within the hour to Venetia to show it to her. And then he went off to make a great speech to armaments workers in Newcastle and said there'd never been a shell crisis. Well, he'd forgotten what actually Kitchener had said, that they were fine for the next attack, but he wasn't saying there hadn't been problems up to that point. This landed Asquith in a lot of trouble and led to a big, you know, it was one of the factors in the end that brought down the government.
One of the little details which Matt was alluding to, I know we've gone past this, so just spooling back just briefly, is you have a section which is basically on the mechanics of declaring war. And there's a red and blue leather-bound, I think it's called the War Book.
That's right.
Which I found fascinating. Like, no, of course, you don't think, oh, let's declare war, I'll find out what's going on, because we hadn't declared war for a while. Can you just explain a little bit about what would have happened at that point?
Yeah, the War Book was the contingency plan, really, for what would happen if an emergency came along. And it had been drawn up by the Committee of Imperial Defence, and nobody thought it was likely to be used. But it was updated every year, and it was it detailed what every main government department was supposed to do when something called the warning telegram had been sent out. And this was the mechanics of going to war, how the whole country could be turned on and made ready to fight. And this book, which I have actually held, there is a copy still exists in the National Archive in Kew, is absolutely fascinating. So there was one telegram would go out. The moment the Foreign Secretary said to the Cabinet, we're in imminent danger of a war, it triggered the war book, and thousands of telegrams were dispatched from ordinary post offices, incidentally. That they had to commandeer the post offices around Whitehall to, here they would go to army headquarters, mayors, to docks, railway stations, and overseas to, again, to the army, to embassies, across the empire. And this was all done in about 30 or 40 minutes. And this really, this is the state of alert. This is kind of DEFCON 4 or whatever. And it was fascinating because I wanted to do a procedural from behind the Prime Minister's desk so that, you know, you saw, see the telegrams he's handling and all the preparations for war and dealing with colleagues, trying to hold the government together. And so that part of the book is a political procedural.
The beauty of the book as well is that we know what's coming. So the title is Precipice, and we know what the precipice is, but the main characters clearly don't. And we know that the First World War is going to cost millions and millions of lives. And there is, for me, a standout section where before, everything starts happening in the war, Asquith is meeting with Lord Kitchener. And the thing that everyone always remembers about First World War is that everyone thought it was going to be over by Christmas. And he's talking to Lord Kitchener, and Kitchener says, this is going to go on till 1917. And Asquith is, that's ridiculously pessimistic. It's 1914 now. There's no way this is going on till 1917. And Kitchener says, and not only that, millions are going to die. Are you ready for the sheer number of casualties? And I just want you to sort of talk a little bit, because obviously that conversation happened. Kitchener saw what was coming.
Yes, Kitchener gets a bad press, really, these days, because he drowned in 1916. He wasn't around to write his war memoirs, so quite a lot of blame. He was a convenient scapegoat. But at the very beginning of the war, he recognised certain things. He said that the war, when Asquith asked him how long the war would go on, he said it will go on till at least 1917. Why? Because we'll need to raise an army of at least 2 million men. That will take us 3 years. They had no conception of the mechanised nature of warfare, or the fact it would engage the whole economy and the whole of society. Kitchener did recognise that. The nearest parallel to what was coming was the American Civil War. American Civil War, to this day, cost more the lives of more American troops than every single war America has fought since. First and Second World War, Vietnam War, Iraq. It cost the lives of between 600,000 and 700,000 men between 1860 and 1865. And this was because there were railways and war slaughter was mechanized. And so clearly a general European land war was going to be an absolute slaughter. And Kitchener saw this, and he also saw that we were sending a relatively tiny army of 50, 60, 70,000 men, which the general staff put on the border with Belgium when the German forces were sweeping across Belgium. And Kitchener said, no, these men need to be back. They need to be near Paris at Amiens. And Asquith overruled him. And, of course, the army was nearly surrounded and wiped out in a huge crisis at the end of August 1914. I mean, it's a riveting time. I mean, perhaps the most interesting time in the First World War. We tend to think of the First World War just in terms of the trenches and so on, but the speed of it at the beginning and the mechanisation of it and the way that they were all swamped. And this feeds into Asquith's obsession with Venetia. The worse things got, the more he needed her. So he would write to her. He'd like to wake up to a letter from her on his bedside table. He'd write to her at the end of the morning after the cabinet meeting and say what had happened. He'd write to her at the end of the afternoon, early evening. Sometimes he'd wander down to the Athenaeum and write to her there. And then at midnight, when he was lying in bed, he'd write a penciled letter to her. And I think it was a safety valve from what he was having to deal with.
When we spoke to you last time, which were, there are a lot of Puritans involved, obviously, in that conversation. And I said to you, I bet in your next book there's going to be no Bible, no prayer book, no Puritans. because what a maddening bunch they are. But actually, I feel as though the role of the Puritans in this book is played by the aristocracy, because you just marvel at their... I mean, they're interesting people, and I think Venetia Stanley's father was the first peer to convert to Islam.
Her uncle converted to Islam.
You know, so there's some interesting people, but what an annoying bunch of people.
Well, they are, and they lived in this exclusive world. You know, the Stanley's London residence was just off Portland Place, and it still stands, and it is enormous. Four huge high windows wide, five stories, and going back, you know, to the mews behind, an immense fortress palace. And they had a huge house at Alderley Edge, 64-bedroom mansion. And they had a huge house near Holyhead, Penrose, which is features quite a lot in the book. And the big two country houses have both gone. I mean, that whole world, that aristocratic enclosed world where there were lots of affairs, lots of children were brought up by their fathers, even though they had actually, their mother had an affair, you know, with someone else. It was a sort of quite louche world. We tend to think that we invented sex in the 1960s, but believe me, the Edwardians were at it, especially in the upper circles, in a way that it makes your eyes pop.
Yes, really. Well, I mean, some people will be scandalized, I suppose, by a relationship between a 60-something man and a 20-something woman, but I was scandalized also by the fact that she was so, when I say useless, she felt useless.
Yes.
When you said she was bored, you know, that here she was, an able, bright, smart woman, had a lot to contribute, and she wasn't allowed to do anything. Her parents wouldn't let her do anything. Now, that's scandalous.
No, she couldn't even vote, of course, and Asquith was one of the great opponents of votes for women. He changed his mind once the war got going and women had to work in the munitions factories. He saw that it was inevitable that they would have to play their part. No, Venetia is interested to me because of that, because she fought to escape the confines of this world where all she was expected to do was marry, really. And she found a way out. She became a nurse. She trained to be a nurse, much to Asquith's dismay, as it meant he couldn't see her nearly as often. And the precipice of the title really refers to a whole society, a whole system of values and life going over a cliff edge. Nothing was ever the same after 1914. That's really the hinge of the modern world. And in the Second World War, which is what I've mostly written about up till now, really is just a continuation of the First World War. Same participants for the same war aims, essentially. So, yeah, these characters, Venetia, Asquith, and Dima, the policeman, locked in this kind of strange emotional pas de trois, I suppose, they all go over the edge together.
We've spoken already about the number of times that when readers pick up this book, the jaw's going to be on the floor because of the indiscretions and the letters that he's sending to Venetia. I wonder, when you were doing your research into this and you were reading those letters, was there a point where even you were surprised by what he was revealing?
Yes, I was constantly surprised, especially as there were some things, two things in particular, which are not in the collected letters, selected letters, I should say, where, you know, one where he pretty makes it pretty clear that they had a strong physical connection. He keeps referring to it was the realest of realities and looking back at it. And he sends her a list of the divisions, obviously most secret, he says to her, of how many divisions there were, Allied divisions, Russian divisions,
amazing,
German divisions, the latest intelligence estimate of the forces on the front. That made my jaw drop. I think I may be the first to realise that the reason he made the great mistake in the speech to munitions workers was because he didn't actually have the evidence in front of him. And then the last two paragraphs of the novel were left out of the collected letters, and they make it pretty clear that he was so distraught when she broke off the relationship with him that he folded the government, really. He invited the Tories to join a coalition, and there was never a Liberal government again. And he makes it pretty clear in those last two paragraphs that he'd never been more unhappy, and he's taken these huge decisions without her counsel and advice.
I should say there is a Puritan who turns up, because you say on page 336 that Asquith lodged as a schoolboy And he was obviously very unhappy with a Puritan chemist and his wife.
Yeah.
So there you go. Deathly hand of Puritanism stretches yes. all the way here. So what was that? Was
well, I think this. His father died when he was young, and his mother, with whom he doesn't seem to have had much of a relationship, packed him off to school in London, first to Pimlico, then to Islington, to lodge with families. It must have been pretty lonely. He poured his heart into work. And lodging with this Puritan family, he used to sneak off when he was about 14, 15, and go to the theatre. And he became obsessed with one particular actress who he fell in love with. I mean, he never met her. Not until, actually, he was Prime Minister. And he did meet her. But and I think it's there that you start to see this. There was always, however successful he was, a kind of melancholy, a kind of yearning. He confessed to that. He was a complicated man. And although we can sit in judgment and say how terrible, and if my father or grandfather had died at Gallipoli, I would perhaps be less sympathetic to him. But on a human level, I can sort of see where it came from, that he had a fissure in him, I think I say this somewhere in the book, that he could never fill, and that was why he took these risks.
You say, and I'm not quite sure if this is you speaking, but this is Asquith in your book, that there are two qualities that a prime minister needs. The first is efficient dispatch in business, so a degree of competency, and optimism, because despair spreads like contagion. Is that from his right? Is that how you think he thought, or had he actually said that?
I think that that's me, but it's pulling together things that I think that he thought. I mean, his the most famous phrase associated with him was wait and see. What is the government's policy going to be? Well, the Honourable Gentleman will have to wait and see. And he was a great procrastinator, and he put off taking decisions because he thought the problems had a habit, but generally, of sorting themselves out, which is not altogether wrong. And he presided with a kind of effortless calm. He didn't give in to despair. Even during the First World War, he was very careful to maintain a facade of optimism at all times. He was very efficient in his dispatch of business because he was so clever. He was like a great judge or lawyer, and he could get through an enormous amount of work with great speed, a decision-making machine, really. And the time that he had left, he liked to have a big lunch every day. He liked to have a big dinner in the evening. He liked to play a lot of bridge. At weekends, he used to always leave London and go and play golf. There's a very funny line of his, actually, which I put in the book. Lady Tree, a friend of the family, they went and played golf in the beginning of 1915. And on the way back, she said to him, "Tell me, Mr. Asquith, do you take an interest in the war at all?" And he wrote to Venetia and said, "Rather sharp, I thought." And people noticed this about him.
So if those were the two things he thought were the qualities needed for a prime minister, what would he make of Keir Starmer, do you think? Efficient dispatch of business and optimism. Because I was reading this when all the kind of it's going to be miserable guys stuff was coming out. If those two qualities are correct, how would Asquith judge Keir Starmer?
Well, he'd appreciate Starmer as a fellow lawyer, I think. And as an administrator, I think that it's clear that the government seems to have overdone the gloom. I mean, if what they want is economic growth, you want a kind of Franklin D. Roosevelt, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, you know, get out there, invest, buy, you know. So I think that that aspect of Starmer, he would not have agreed with at all.
What do you think is Asquith's legacy? Because I was in mind of we've already talked about Munich and Neville Chamberlain. Munich went some way, certainly for me, in rehabilitating Neville Chamberlain. How do you think Asquith is now viewed, given what we've read from your book?
I think that Asquith was a good, very good peacetime prime minister, perhaps a bit like Chamberlain to that extent. He was not expert in war and didn't he wanted to avoid the war, but it became impossible. He was the man who introduced old age pensions in Britain. It's often credited to Lloyd George, but actually it was Asquith. And he presided over great changes in the constitution, the rise of organised labour, and he held the country together at a time when things were falling apart. And he tried desperately to find a solution to the Irish problem. And maybe if he'd introduced Irish Home Rule, perhaps they might have headed off the horrible things that happened in the 20s and afterwards. But they were over. He was swept away like a sort of timber-framed building by the floodwaters of the First World War. And he was replaced, in a kind of coup, really, by Lloyd George. And he never really recovered from that. And the Liberal Party was smashed. So he's the last Victorian Prime Minister. And he is a sort of transitional figure, I suppose. He didn't understand the modern media in the way that Churchill and Lloyd George, his colleagues, did. But what a government he presided over. Churchill, Lloyd George, Haldane, Kitchener, an incredible constellation of talent.
I must say, I read the book, enjoying it hugely, but with a sense of foreboding. So you're writing, certainly the first part of the book is the summer of 1914. And as other books and other films have shown, it was an incredible summer. It was a stunning summer. And I read a lot of your book in the garden with this sort of late September sunshine, with the news coming on and Putin making his threats about war, and thinking the mechanics of war seem to are moving again, you know? I mean, partly this is a weather-induced observation reading your book, but I don't know, it just felt a scary read to me.
Yeah, I think there is a slight 1914 vibe in the air. You know, 1914 had been preceded by a long period of peace, and there were believed to be institutions in place that would prevent war, and that war was unthinkable. And then they proved completely fragile. The alliances, far from deterring war, accelerated, like mountain climbers. One falls off the edge of the cliff and suddenly everyone, they're not holding them, they're all tumbling as well. And we have also had a long period of peace since 1945, relatively speaking, at least for us here. And but the institutions seem to be crumbling. The EU, which we've left, the NATO, with the Americans threatening, if Trump wins, to withdraw from that. And so it's almost as if there's a kind of recklessness in the air and a feeling that things are building up. It's like a pressure cooker needs to explode. And But I'd rather like Asquith. I'm an optimist. And maybe I hope I don't prove to be deluded, but I agree with you, and there is a sense of technology with AI and drones and so on, that it's starting. What seemed unthinkable, a conventional war because of nuclear weapons, suddenly seems more thinkable. That, you know, we're starting to... I was really struck when the German ambassador said they didn't want to give the latest missiles to Ukraine. Why? Because they can hit the Kremlin. And you... When I heard that, it was like one of those moments where you think, now I see how everything could go to hell in a handcart.
So where does your optimism come from?
Because I'm essentially an optimistic person, and like Asquith, I don't believe there's any point in being too gloomy about everything, and one can wish oneself almost into a worse crisis if one's not careful. But, you know, it was in no one's real economic benefit to fight the First World War, but they still fought it, and it broke a British power. There was a huge row. When Asquith introduced old age pensions, the Tory party thought there would be a revolution, and it cost £50 million. And the total cost to the British in that money was £8 billion. I mean, we never really recovered from going over that precipice.
Yeah. What are you working on next, Robert? Can you?
Well, I'm thinking about this and that, and I've generally got two or three ideas, and it's just a matter of which of them sort of seems to be coming to the boil.
It's a very Asquithian answer. I think I have to wait and see.
Well, I'm only telling you the truth. I mean, you will be the first. You guys will be the first to know. But I think, I mean, I have no hobbies. All I really like is writing. So that's what, if I'm not writing, I'm completely bored. So, you know, I just, I will get started on something quite soon, I'm sure.
It's always a pleasure. We look forward to every appearance, Robert.
Well, it's always lovely to come and see you.
Robert Harris's book is Precipice. There'll be another chat with Robert along in a few days' time when he does our Q&A again. But for the moment, Robert Harris, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.